2007 PNB meeting in Houston, Texas, and by each of the five network stations' local station board delegate assemblies. It must pass by a majority vote at three of the five stations. For the full text of this bylaws amendment, log on to pacifica.org or call 510-849-2590, extension 207, to request a copy by mail.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA FM, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Program.
It's like it sucked all the chi right out of me. I'm like, oh, and even the animals were like, what's the matter with you? So we've gathered to replenish ourselves, but I think Terry Pratchett in his great novel, The Light Fantastic, does a little review of the Bush regime and the staged reading of last night. He says, Rincewind stared and knew that there were far worse things than evil. All the demons in hell would torture your very soul, but that was precisely because they valued souls very highly. Evil would always try to steal the universe, but at least it considered the universe worth stealing. But the gray world, behind those empty eyes, would trample and destroy without even according its victims the dignity of hatred. It wouldn't even notice them. All right, thank you, Terry Pratchett, for your review of the current Bush regime. And how do we replenish and spell each other like wolves and geese? Geese spell each other the lead goose. Wolves, we know, their leadership dynamic it's the calmest and the most dynamically playful wolf. And so we go, let's combine wolf and geese leadership. So it was some weeks back that we had our great ally Malik Rahim reporting from New Orleans, and it was grim. It was very grim. It was like, and we let him speak because it was important to go, how grim it is. And a good-hearted caller called in suggesting, why don't we imagine blue-violet light? We go, yes, we say, let's imagine blue-violet light, but while we're writing checks. And many people did. We say spirit and action, vision and action, you know, the title of my book, Making the Gods Work for You. But we say the gods don't want to do 51%. They'll do 50%. But they want us to chime in. So vision and action. The former without the latter really goes nowhere. It's really hinayana honky self-indulgence. And the latter without the former is tyrannically humorless and ineffective and indulgent and ranting and all of those things. So more than perfectly today, to collaborate in protecting and keeping as much alive as possible in this time of dire beauty, we are joined by our great ally, Native Athabascan IAC activist Dune Lankert. At the website, you can give us more, but is nativeconservancy.org. He can speak of so much good that he's done, preserving the wild, protecting the salmon, but now he's in the middle of one of his biggest projects, which is really for all of us and for which he needs our help. It's the acquisition and preservation of the Bering Cold Fields. So we want to participate in this collaborative story that is of great import to us all. So welcome, Dune, Eagle Clan, IAC of the Eagle Clan from the Copper River Delta. Welcome.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely honored to be on your show.
Well, that's great. I mean, the last time we spoke on the air was with our great ally, David Grimes, and it was right when we have this New Orleans-Alaska connection. It was right when the levees broke. We did a live show from Alaska about the importance of rivers and deltas, and here we are again. And I think it's important. You did just win an Ashoka Fellowship, and maybe you can just give us a little bit of that, where you're getting some support coming in, and then we'll dive into the huge project before us that we want to actually have tangible help manifested this hour.
Yes, I You know, I think that that's important for people to realize that their voice and their actions can make a difference, and especially in places like Alaska where you still have a chance to make a huge difference. And by winning this Ashoka Fellowship in the last couple of months, it's proven to me that there are people listening and they're, you know, out there. And so I think there's an audience that I think now needs to turn their voices and their listening into action. And so I'm really excited that, you know, finally after 17 years that people are recognizing the work that we're doing in saving habitat in Alaska here. And as you know, Caroline, from coming down the Copper River with us, that over the last 17 years, we've been able to preserve about 700,000 acres of wild salmon habitat along our coastal temperate rainforest, which is the northern end of the forest that starts in Alaska and, you know, goes all the way down through Oregon, Washington, California. And, you know, that's the salmon habitat that is supported indigenous peoples for thousands and thousands of years. And so on our end of the forest, we got a chance to preserve a way of life that is comparable to none.
And also, the, I know it was small land, but big heart. You know, when we came down the Copper River, there was this one particularly lively place, and the bears were fishing for the salmon and teaching the young bears how to fish, and there was seals going, no, don't look at them, look at us, we're doing the backstroke, and there were wolf tracks, and you told us how you'd save that place. Can you tell us again? It was this crucial, wonderful, lively place was under threat. People wanted to take tour boats to it, and you stepped in.
Yes, that was one of our recent victories in the last year. Is there was a developer that wanted to build a bear viewing stand and a cabin and have jet boats running up to this place called Abercrombie Rapids. And I don't know if your listeners know of the McNeil River, but it's like the area where all of the mama bears along the Copper River bring all their baby bears to teach them how to fish. And it's also an area where the wolf population in Alaska, there's only several packs that actually feed off of wild salmon. And because our Copper River salmon have, you know, outrageous omega-3s and high in protein and oil content, the wolves along the Copper River as well as the bears, that is their sanctuary where they are able to thrive and take care of their young. And so right there at Abercrombie Rapids, it's not uncommon to see both wolves and bears eating the salmon. And so the last couple years, we did everything we possibly could to try and figure out how to avert that development from happening. And I was able to actually top file on the land claim out there, and I was able to get that area and preserve it as a sacred spot. And the importance of the region, you know, it's hard to even describe, because the life on the Copper River, right in that area, it's where the river comes together, and it's the narrowest, so it's really swift running water. And there's these huge boulders, as you remember out there, that create these huge eddies. So when you have 25,000 wild Copper River sockeyes and king salmon going by a day right through the Abercrombie Rapids, they get caught in these little eddies where the mama bears are able to just, you know, swat down in the water and scoop out a salmon. And the mama bears chase off all the papa bears. So the smaller bears are able to actually fish that region, and it's the easiest fishing, and they'll learn how to take care of themselves. And so, you know, if you look at different areas along the Copper River Delta and the Bering River region, and even, you know, upwards of the Copper River watershed, which is 17 million acres of land, it is by far one of the most sacred sites along the Copper River, because it supports all life.
That was so heartening. And now you're undertaking one of your largest projects that you say you've been working on for 10 years, which is the preservation of the Bering River region and what's known as the Bering Coalfields, to keep the coal, to keep the carbon in the ground. And yeah, you can guide us into this, but it is, all stories lead us to all stories. This is a great one, I think, that is crucial to all of us. It's like if we can back you up and spell you, then it's important for all life on the planet, because there's a South Korean fellow who wants to do good. There's everything. It's a movie, really. Guide us into, again, the Bering River region, the Bering River coal fields, and how close you are to being able to do this crucial thing, which could be a prototype around the world.
Okay. This is really an exciting, doable conservation project that I think some of your listeners will find very intriguing. The Copper River Delta region in the early 1900s was the topic of conversation politically, nationally. It went to a Supreme Court decision that was led by President Roosevelt at the time, and the first head of the Forest Service, Gifford Pinchot. What they had aligned their forces back then was that the Guggenheims and the J.P. Morgans of the world put together an entity called the Alaska Syndicate. And basically what they wanted to do was figure out how to create a monopoly to take all of the copper ore out of Kennecott, which is up near McCarthy on the Upper Copper, and figure out how they were going to power all their locomotives to bring all this copper ore, which was valued at several hundred million dollars back then, which would be several billion dollars today, bring that down from McCarthy down to Chitna, all the way down 110 more miles down to Cordova, where they had made Cordova into a port city. Now, the people of Cordova at the time, they wanted to access the Bering River coal field as well as the Alaska Syndicate, because what they wanted to do was to take one resource by monopolizing the other and power their locomotives using the Bering coal field. This way they could destroy both resources and basically take the resources for free. Well, the President Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot, they challenged that, saying that it was a monopoly of public resources, and this decision was played out for several years, and it led to the beginning of the conservation movement in America. And what happened was the Guggenheims and the J.P. Morgans were stopped by the administration, the Roosevelt administration, because what they did was they said that you could not monopolize one resource to take the other. And so basically what happened here in Cordova, where I live, which is 55 miles to the east of the region, the people of Cordova actually had a Boston Tea Party and were taking foreign coal and throwing it into the ocean down near the ferry dock. And the reason they were doing that was because they wanted the jobs and the money to open up the Bering River coal fields, thinking that that was going to be the new economy and the new industry for the region. And so while this whole thing was being played out, my grandmother, Ataki, she was no longer able to burn the coal because they were throwing it overboard, and it was in the middle of winter, and so she wasn't able to keep her 12 children warm. So while she was out gathering wood to burn in her fireplace, the city of Cordova burned down her house and bulldozed it over to build the foundations of the new port for to make Cordova the terminal of this Bering coalfield and this copper mine from McCarthy. And so, industry certainly had its way with this community, but what had happened was it polarized a lot of the people, but at the same time, it created a conservation movement and a legacy that continues today. So here we are 100 years later, the 100-year anniversary of the Chugach National Forest that was created back then, which was the largest national forest in America. The next one, you know, several months later, was the Tongass National Forest. But the Chugach was on the map. And so here we are 100 years later. Now this same coal field is becoming a topic of political controversy, and all the developers, everybody who feels that we should diversify the economy by destroying all the resources, are lining up their forces, and they want to build this 55-mile road across the delta and then go 25 miles to the north to take out oil and gas and coal and trees and destroy the very salmon habitat, which is one of the last wild thriving runs of salmon on planet Earth. We receive the highest prices of salmon in Alaska, and if not the world. And so, like, even though Bristol Bay, you know, has 30 to 40, 45 million returning sockeyes, their price per pound is about 50 to 60 cents a pound if they're lucky. We see $3.50, $4 a pound, but we only have 1 million to 2 million sockeyes annually. We only have 30 to 50,000 king salmon. So our salmon are by far the most prized wild salmon on planet Earth. So why would you want to destroy a sustainable, thriving, existing economy that has supported the people for thousands of years before the money culture came along? It supported our subsistence way of life. Now they want to destroy that for short-term gain. And so I think right now that if the people of the planet who really want to make a difference and make sure that the last of our wild places not only continue to exist, but continue to support the people who believe in them, people need to understand that these wild salmon that they're buying in the stores, those come from us. You know, we're all in this together. So it's a consumer choice as well. And so, you know, it just seems to me that we have this incredible opportunity to continue the conservation legacy, to preserve one of the last wild places on planet Earth that still supports the people that want to live this way.
That's so well said, Gushton. And also the ancestral resonance. I mean, it's your grandmother, and then it's Gifford Pinchot, and then it's Theodore Roosevelt. And some of the people you're working with are Theodore Roosevelt IV and Gifford Pinchot III, right?
Yes, and we were able to get Dr. Jane Goodall to give us a hand, and Dennis Hayes from the Bullitt Foundation.
Right.
We're working with Susanna Colorado.
Yes.
I mean, you know, we're really bringing a lot of people, you know, who are world conservationists together, because they realize that, you know, I mean, the Copper River Delta, you know, yes, it's important for its wild salmon, but it's also one of the flyways that is one of the most important flyways for all of the birds that fly up and down the Coosa Timber Rainforest. And we have like 20 million birds that come up here every spring. And, you know, this is their home. This is like, you know, there's a saying, when the tide goes out, the table is set. Well, that's, you know, what these birds and these salmon and this wildlife, this is what they thrive on. And so when you think about, you know, the history of time and the changes in the environment and the changes to the people, not only in our thinking but in our actions. When you go back, let's say, to 1964, okay, you have the nation's worst earthquake, in especially Alaska's, and the delta rises and Prince William Sound sinks as many as 12 to 50 feet in either direction. And so 25 years later, on the date of Good Friday, on the anniversary of the 1964 earthquake, we have the nation's worst oil spill, the Exxon Valdez. You know, we're worried about Good Friday, and we're thinking about this earthquake, and guess what? On the 25th anniversary, we have the nation's worst oil spill. And so our region, our habitat, our way of life is impacted again. And you know, and I feel that, you know, it was a wake-up call, certainly, you know, for me and a lot of my fishing buddies, you know, people who, you know, are making a living from the sea. That oil spill impacted the same habitat that was affected from the 1964 earthquake. And so, you know, things are all related, and, you know, and it was just another wake-up call for us to figure out, you know, how to protect the habitat. But at the time of the oil spill in 1989 on March 24th, we were trying to figure out how to save the salmon habitat that the native corporations were getting ready to clear cut from Cordova to Kodiak, because they were trying to figure out how to diversify the economy and pay dividends to their thousands of shareholders. Well, you know, we're trying to figure out, well, how can we come up with an economic alternative to this natural resource destruction that's certainly going to impact their subsistence and commercial fishing lifestyle? So, bam, we have the nation's worst oil spill. But what we did was create that incredible negative and turn it into an amazing positive by getting a $1 billion out-of-court settlement from Exxon to help restore the very habitat that they destroyed. So it set a precedent by giving us funds to purchase the timber harvesting rights away from the native corporations, therefore protecting 700,000 acres of habitat that would have ultimately led to 1 million acres being clear cut in the spill zone. And to me, I can never understand how or why you would think that clear cutting the very same habitat along the exact parallel path of the nation's worst oil spill is going to help our subsistence or commercial fishing lifestyle. That was beyond me. But I felt that as long as we had an economic alternative to the destruction, that we would be able to save the habitat. And because of the nation's worst oil spill, that's what presented itself, and that's how we were able to save our land.
Yeah, that's so exciting and brilliant. I remember when you were showing me and going, and David Grimes apparently was part of that deal, saving 700,000 acres as well. And then also, just as a little sidebar, and then we'll head back to the Bering Coalfields, but you've also been working on, you know, again, to heal that breach between environmentalists and fisher people and timber people and so on, saying how can we also generate money to keep people, to pay people to become educated and to not fish for a season. Wasn't that one of the projects we talked about around the fire?
Yes, yeah, because, you know, I still believe that that fishermen are conservationists. You know, they believe in the habitat. They believe in their way of life. You know, they want to see sustainable economies just like everybody else. And so I think with, you know, some of the remaining Exxon funds, there's about $150 million in the restoration reserve for anticipated harm from the Exxon Valdez. And we just asked Exxon for an additional $92 million for unanticipated damages from the Exxon Valdez. And so I think with some of these monies, we could actually pay fishermen not to fish to help become preservationists, to help restore the region back to its pre-spill condition. And when the runs warrant a sustainable fishery, then we wouldn't have to pay fishermen to not fish. But I think that, you know, right now, there's a number of ways that we could do it that if, you know, everyone had to come to the table as a stakeholder and say, okay, this is what I'm willing to do, and this is what we're going to have to do as inhabitants of this region and as stakeholders who all have a say and a stake in the management of the region, that this is what we're willing to do. And this is why, you know, I was telling you, Caroline, that I've always believed that if the fishermen would join forces with the native peoples and sit down with the conservationists and preserve all 17 million acres of the Copper River watershed and all 5.5 million acres of the Chugach National Forest, what would happen is not only would the people out there who market all of the salmon be guaranteed that salmon will be here forever and at least come back every single year, that they will get paid more because people will see that we care about the environment. We care about how we manage our resources. We care about the wild salmon habitat. Because what's happening here in Alaska and what's happening all up and down the coast of timber rainforest, and people see this more and more, is they're building hatcheries or they're building fish farms. But hatcheries don't require habitat, and the fish don't spawn and die. So that means that the developers want to see hatcheries. And the Bush administration, even while he was, you know, in his first few years in office, tried to take coastal temperate rainforest salmon off the endangered species list because he said that the hatcheries were replacing the wild stocks. Well, that's not good enough. We need to make sure that we save our salmon habitat so there will always be a sustainable, thriving run of wild salmon.
Yeah, we used to say the tide was shifting, but really it has shifted. There are these strange alliances and a common vision. The NRA has just now come out against the Bush administration opening up public lands, for looting and mining because it's restricting hunting. So as you say, you know, fishermen are intrinsically conservationists. We say, so are hunters. And you are one of the great voices to present this common and shared vision. And so here's where we get also to the great teaching exercise of the Bering Cold Fields. I'll just sort of jumpstart us. My tiny bit that I gleaned from our conversation is that there is a South Korean owner of the Bering Cold Fields who is an elder who would like to make his legacy by selling it into your domain protection where it would be safe. And wasn't part of also what you were saying too, is that for any company that says it's really dedicated to alternative sustainable fuels, then this is a great statement saying, see, we are not going to touch this. We are so dedicated. Is that part of the deal?
Yes. And the importance of this is I think, you know, it really does have global, international implications, because in Korea, the majority of their power comes from the burning of coal. Same as China, same as Taiwan, different regions around the world. I mean, 50% of America's power, if not more, comes from burning coal. In Korea, and I've been over there twice, in Korea, what happens is that as long as you continue to burn coal, those people will never probably see the sun in their lifetime. It's already to that point. And so a lot of people have asthma and they have allergies. And, I mean, I can barely breathe over there. My chest, you know, just feels like it's literally going to cave in because of the heaviness of the pollutants that are in the air quality. And so when you have a Korean developer who has raised $50 billion to burn fossil fuels and pump it into our veins around the world, interested in doing conservation, in this case, sequestration, leaving the coal in the ground, I feel that the whole world should take notice that here is a elderly developer, lawyer, coal mine owner who is willing to sell a subsurface fossil fuel for conservation purposes because he wants to do the right thing. He wants to look at renewable energy. He wants to look at alternative energy. He wants to figure out, you know, how he can help us get off of fossil fuels because he sees that the tide is changing. He sees that the people are trying to figure out how we're going to combat global warming and that it is a real issue and that it is a global issue. And so for him to negotiate with us for the last 10 years, we got close a couple of times. Both of those deals fell apart for a number of reasons and different variables. But the bottom line is this. We have an opportunity to take 12,000 acres of subsurface rights, which there's only been one or two other subsurface deals done on fossil fuels, leaving them in the ground, done in America. And I believe those were on public land, not private. So we have a chance to take 12,000 acres of subsurface rights and take it off the market and retire it for conservation for $7.9 million. We've raised $2 million so far. We have until March 31st of this year, so we've got a couple more months to raise the balance, to do a visionary conservation deal that will lead to more subsurface rights being sold. And the way that I look at it is this, Caroline, that here we are concerned about the environment, we're concerned about the air quality, we're concerned about clean water and human rights and indigenous rights and all these different things. All of those components are a part of this deal. This is about returning the stewardship of native interests and lands back to native hands and people, being fishermen, people who want to live a sustainable way of life in balance and harmony with our part of the planet.
That's great. We're gonna take a very short break in which we will hear rousing We Can Do It music, and then we will return with our guest Dune Lenkert, and we will gather Serious Woof, and we'll be right back in a very short moment. Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Our guest today is our great ally, Dune Lenkert. He is dedicated, well, to many projects that we're talking about, but especially of, as he says, the opportunity to take 12,000 acres and retire it, the Visionary Conservation Deal to retire the Bering coal fields so that they are never developed. And we go, oh, and that music was, it's the most rousing music I know, the Axiom of Change. And I just love visualizing when, in that particular break too, going, here come the wolves, here comes Dune Lenkert, here comes everybody, here comes the visionary activists, we can do this stuff. So again, if you're very patient and on point, you can join us by calling 510-848-4425. But we're looking, again, just as we train ourselves as visionary activists, going, blue-violet light, very good, but while you're writing in check. Dune's putting on the table also that we want to spiral out, and Dune and his team, for, on behalf of all of us, you said you'd like to raise $6 million by March 31st, right?
That is correct. And, you know, and I think it's important for the listeners and any, you know, potential donors or visionary people who, you know, actually want to change the world by keeping it the same, is that we right now have an opportunity for a huge domino effect on the Copper River Delta. And again, remember I said that, you know, the 300-mile river going up to the upper watershed and the delta itself is 17 million acres of land. By taking the coal off the market, this 12,000 acres, we'll be able to stop this 55-mile road across the Delta. We'll be able to stop the 25-mile road down to Catella. We'll be able to stop oil and gas drilling and the harvesting of about 73,000 acres of trees, which there's about 10,000 acres of merchantable timber that the native corporations want to cut. But to me, it's about sustainability. It's about the long-term sustainable economy that has supported this region and that will continue to support the region if we respect the resource. And so right now, you know, there is a scientist like this fella, this friend of mine, Connie Mankin. He said that when you destroy or develop 10% of wild salmon habitat, you could very well destroy the run of that salmon. And so if you look up and down the coast of timber rainforest, there was no commercial fishery in Oregon, Washington, and California this year. Canada has been hard hit from the clear cutting that they've done in that region. The different mines that they want to do in different rivers. Like now they want to do the Pebble Mine over in Bristol Bay. I mean, we're talking, you know, about destroying the largest, biggest fishery on planet Earth. For what? One corporation's gain and a few jobs and a few dividends for people who are willing to sacrifice that way of life for a short-term job. And that makes no sense, and those people should not be in charge of making those decisions because obviously they've lost their wisdom. And so right now, we have this incredible opportunity to save one of the last wild spots on planet Earth. And I think it's really important that people take the responsibility that they should not believe everything that they think, and that they have the responsibility to speak truth to power. And when they know that something is wrong, and they know what that really needs to happen that is right, then they have to speak up. You have to be louder than everything else. You have to be courageous. You have to step up to the plate. And you got to take responsibility for what you know and the knowledge that you have. Because, you know, when I think about the legacy that we leave our children and the legacy that comes after us, I don't want to say that we tried the best we could and good luck and you're on your own. I don't want to say that we didn't do enough. And I want to make sure that those children have a sporting chance, that they have an opportunity to have the life that we've had here in Alaska. I mean, growing up as a commercial fisherman and as a native person and as a conservationist later in life over the last 17 years since the oil spill, I am honored to speak up and fight for the animals and the fish and this way of life that is comparable to none. And so with, you know, your listeners' help and every visionary person out there that believes that we should leave something more than bad decision debt to our children, you know, will speak up and they can make a difference. Because the reality is this, Caroline, we have less wild places every single day. Therefore, they become more valuable. So that means that we have to do a little bit more. And by changing the public interest valuation process and by including intrinsic values instead of just economic values to conservation, then we won't be sitting around waiting for imminent threats like this development to happen. We'll be visionary and courageous in taking action before. Therefore, we'll be able to spend less and save more while we still can.
That's excellent. You're in fine fiddle, Dylan. You're really great. And also, the business section of the Washington Post Wednesday says Bush lifts oil drill ban in Alaska's Bristol Bay. Is that part of what you were referring to?
Yep, that's the Pebble Mine project and offshore and onshore drilling. And so, you know, it's huge. The attack that Alaska is under is huge. And just so you know, too, and this is all part of the whole equation, because this is what we started out talking about, the oil spill, is the Exxon settlement, the $5 billion settlement that we won in 1994, that has been reduced by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals down to $2.5 billion. That means that people aren't going to become billionaires. That means that people are going to actually have to figure out how to restore the habitat and the fisheries back to when, in 1988, Cordova was the eighth leading seafood port in dollars made in America. Now we're not even in the top 100. Now the importance of restoration and preservation and community activism is on our hands. It's on our shoulders. It's going to be up to the people to do the restoration that is needed in the spill zone. And that's why the work that we're doing, yes, we started the EAC Preservation Council, which is a cultural and legal defense fund. We started the Native Conservancy Land Trust so we can buy land and give it back to the Indians and put them back in as stewards of their land. We started the Fund for Indigenous Rights and the Environment, which is an endowment to help indigenous peoples to look at conservation as an economic alternative to development. Now we want to build a school out in Night Island in Prince William Sound so we can take this $400 million in science that shows that oil and water don't mix and put it to work in the spill zone communities so they can help restore their own way of life. Because it's obvious that these courts in America can be bought by the richest corporations in the world who are willing to appeal the people who have been impacted, who are on the front line of their regions. That the ones that right now, out of the 30,000 plaintiffs, 20%, 6,000 of those plaintiffs have died. That'll never see compensation. And so, you know, the way I feel is that we're not doing enough. People on the planet should be looking at us as an example of how we need to do it right and change the way things are being done. Because, you know, when it's over with us, you're next. And so, you know, and it's already been in the reverse of that, because we've already seen what's happened. And we're the case study, we're the baseline of how to do it right. And so as long as we keep the place intact, as long as we keep it wild, as long as it's thriving, as long as the fish are jumping and dancing and singing, we win. Everybody gets fed.
So let's put on our work table right now. You know, how can people write you a check for $1 million? How do they find you? Where do we siphon this? How do we invite it? And then we'll talk about the cleansing of money from, you know, funky ancestors and foundations and what people who don't have a lot of money but who have a lot of goodwill can spiral into it too. But for people who'd like to write you a check for $6 million, say, how would they do that?
Well, people can check out our website at www.redzone.org, or they can email us at coal@redzone.org, or they can call our office here in Cordova at the Yak Preservation Council at 907-424-5890. Or if they want to get a hold of me directly, they can email me dune@redzone.org. And they can certainly check out your website, because, you know, I think that, you know, right now we have a short window of opportunity, but a huge, incredible precedent that could be set if we just all put our minds and our hearts and our wallets together and save this place, because we can.
Yes, absolutely, and again, it's the trickster deal, and it's also part of the, you know, you have the ancestral Roosevelts and the ancestral Pinchos and so on, putting some of their resources and certainly their time on the table. But it's interesting. I mean, I know so many kind of spiritual teacher who's a pretty good, but with a lot of, you know, wealth, money in back of them that comes from very funky things, and it does cause the ancestors strange symptoms. It's sort of like the haunting of the ghosts. And so I think part of the experiment also, too, is for people who've come into large foundation money who kind of track where does that money come from and how do they cleanse it. So it's good, you know, backing up spiritual teachers and stuff, but this also is an invitation to go and hear how you could really make redress for any funky money one might have inherited. And that might be just a part of it, and then there's foundations and all of that. But let's go to our first caller. The ghost voices are dim, but it's somebody in Sonoma.
This also is an invitation to go and hear how you could really make redress for any funky thing one might have inherited. And that might be.
That's hello. I'm hearing a playback of myself.
Oh, this is Carol in Sunnyvale. Is that you there?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Great, excellent. Yes, quick suggestion on how to generate some extra funding, even though I am a little peon in this player. We all connect with higher wisdom. What I would love to do is be able to send a check to a post office box for those of us who are not connected. And I'm sure we also have some elderly people who are not connected on the internet. So we would like a post office box to send a check to. And what I would love in exchange is a certificate, because I would like, for instance, to be able to write a check for $25 and to have a certificate made out to my grandniece with her name on it saying that she has a sacred stake in this cherished land.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So, Dune,
and the other thing is, and one other quick thing, the other thing is I would love to see some outreach done, because we have many, scout troops, many other troops, great people, kids with lots of energy looking for projects, and there would be nothing I could think of a higher reason for being than to have them be able to do fundraisers for this and have them have certificates for each troop.
Excellent. Excellent agent ally caller. Thank you so much. That's great. Dune, is there a P.O. box where people can send small money with big heart?
Yes. You can make checks payable to the EAC Preservation Council. That's EYAK Preservation Council, or EPC would be fine. And you can send it to P.O. box 460, that's 460, Cordova, CORDOVA, Alaska, and our zip code is 99574. That's 99574.
And perhaps you will have your team of elves and wolves design a little certificate such as our caller had in mind for her great niece.
Yes. Well, you know, years ago, Carol Hoover and I talked about, you know, putting together a certificate that was called Bear Shares. And what they were is, you know, when people made donations, they were actually buying bear shares to save salmon habitat. And, you know, and I think that, you know, now's the perfect time to finish that up and make that happen. Because I think, you know, she's right that, you know, there's people out there that, you know, I write a lot of thank you notes to a lot of people who support our work over the years. And, you know, and I think having a certificate on helping us save this 17 million acres, you know, would go a long ways for educating other people what's possible.
It is crucial. All my Christmas shopping virtually was Defenders of Animals, in which they send a small stuffed animal that my coyote stole and took under the house. But to people, because so much right now when we think about, oh, polar bears, it's like, oh, or the salmon, like, oh. And we want something that makes us feel like, ah, as opposed to like, oh, no. And that's what you and we can get Carol Hoover back there, bicycling her computer to design these certificates. But I think that's a great idea. Let's go to John in Berkeley with another great practical suggestion, perhaps.
Yes, hello. Good afternoon, Caroline. I love this show. There's two things. First of all, I am a hunter, and I am also an environmentalist, and I do not see any contradiction between the two. And neither does a gentleman who is in charge of an organization called the Rewilding Institute. His name is David Foreman. He's one of the founders of Earth First, and this is an organization, and they are into restoration of wild habitat and turning it back into wilderness and the preservation of populations of large megafauna, including carnivores, which goes into another organization people can access called the Center for Biological Diversity. They are the most effective when it comes to endangered species. They've made the EPA and the Fish and Wildlife Service do their job. So I wanted to pass that on to listeners.
That's great. And Dune, I know that you've been working on this project to preserve the Bering coal fields and keep the coal in the ground for 10 years. And I don't know if you think of any part of it as pertinent or little teaching lessons of where deals came together and then, oh, no, they fell apart. You know, as our team learns how to effectively organize and not undercut itself, is there any distilled offering you might have about how, you know, or calling forth to all of us to behave well and ally etiquette and not undermine each other and not be sneaky? And, you know, is there any... anything you've gleaned from where it was like, oh, almost, but not quite?
Yeah, I think that, you know, what we've learned over the years is that, you know, everybody in different organizations have different agendas and different charters and different mission statements and different reasons why they do things. But I think what it all comes down to is, you know, what will it take to really change the world? And I think, you know, we need to start out by being that change that we want to see in the world and turning caring into action, you know, turning love into action, turning apathy and angst into action. I think that what we need to do as individuals when we come together and we focus on a region, and not just focusing on a hotspot, but focusing on a region and saying that we really want to figure out how to preserve it and take care of it, is that we need to come up with a comprehensive strategy on how we're going to work together to save the last of these places, rather than, you know, having isolated events where, you know, we have just a handful of people saving all 17 million acres of the Delta, or a handful of people like David Grimes and Rick Steiner and Ricky Ott and Carol Hoover and Jennifer Gibbons and Dune Lankard and all these amazing people who have been saving Prince William Sound from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. You know, we need to all figure out how to set our differences aside and focus on what our strengths are, and direct the energy, whether that's time, money, or love, in the direction that needs it most, and save these places while we can. And so, you know, I can only say that in all the experiences that I've had, it's when our egos and our baggage gets in the way of common sense and our wisdom, because we all have the right intentions and good intentions to do the right thing, but it takes a lot of courage to set those egos and those agendas aside and just focus on being a part of the solution rather than a part of the problem. Because the reality is that when we sit around and we look at conservation as a whole, and we sit around and we go, well, you know, until they build a road or they subdivide that, or until they decide that they're actually going to develop that, that's when we're going to get involved. That's when the price of that real estate or that opportunity triples in value. All of a sudden, we're willing to spend more money to save less habitat. when we could have spent less money and saved more. So it, what it all comes down to is that, you know, we just need to start out thinking, you know, some of the people who want to destroy the remaining wild places that we have left. And all we have to do is think differently on how we take action. And, you know, and again, time, money, and love, whatever you got, that's what we need.
That's great. Yeah, and I think also that it is that, that quality of vision and spirit, which says if we concentrate on the desirable vision, then avenues of possibility open up that weren't immediately apparent, you know, so that, you know, we don't want to be contained by realism. And I think that's where a lot of our teammates get depressed and you know, due to magic deficiency by realism going, oh, it's so terrible, oh, it's so bleak. And we go, yes, but we're going to compost that, and here's the vision. And, you know, again, I like our writer ally, Terry Pratchett, saying, oh, it's 1,000-to-1 odds. But then the great witch says, yes, but 1,000-to-1 odds crop up 9 times out of 10. So you're certainly familiar with that, of being against all odds trickster, and then pulling this together with time and money and love, and seeing the desirable, and then having things open up. Because on one level we'd say $6 million, quite a lot, but not really. You know, it's like, oh, all right, we could do this, team, you know, and extending outreach as well. And so again, just to put the desirable vision of you beaming with happiness by March 31st, which would be a good read for the whole world, basically. You're just going, oh, da, da, da. So is that when you want the, that's when you need the commitments to take the coal fields off the market. Is that right?
Yes. By March 31st of 2007, we have to have the full $7.9 million committed, so we can then go through the transaction to take that coal patent off the market. And, you know, and I think a good way to, you know, envision what this significance of this region is imagine if an investor or a developer wanted to purchase 1 acre of, or one full block of land in downtown San Francisco, or downtown New York, or even in Washington, D.C., or in, you know, any of these metropolis cities. It would probably cost you millions and millions and millions of dollars to buy that one block, so you could rule that one block. We're talking about preserving 12,000 acres of the richest, finest habitat on planet Earth for $7.9 million for the rest of time. And it will, you know, continue to support our sustainable, existing, thriving wild salmon fishery that brings in about $25 to $30 million annually for this community. And those fish then get sold to all the people who love wild salmon, because not everybody loves to eat farm salmon, which is bad for you. And friends should not let their friends eat farm salmon. And then you have the hatchery fish issue, which we already went into. So, you know, we have this incredible opportunity to be part of a major solution by working together. And, you know, and it's all up to us, and I'm in.
That's right. No, absolutely.
I'm in.
That, absolutely. You are in both feet and wings. And we do say, yes, the compelling, the incredible illusion that realism and idealism are somehow estranged, when we go, absolutely, as you say, you know, if our vision is just a little bit longer than the tip of our nose, then yes, the rainforest worth more, even in crude economic terms, is rainforest than is two season of Burger King. Or what you're saying also, this, exactly, you translate it wonderfully well. And that sense of, oh, here we go. So let's go to our caller, Trudy in Emeryville. Come in, Trudy.
Hi. I just caught the tail end of the show, and I was I see it as a really good, from what I heard, a role model for what, for my interest that I have in Alaska, which has to do with the Yukon Flats, which is slated for development, oil development. And I was wondering if you knew anything about I'm gonna look to your website. I was hoping you could state those again, your websites. I was wondering if you knew what stage they were in, and if letters being written would be helpful, or which organization is dealing with the Yukon Flats development.
Okay, Dunn.
Which wildlife interests
first,
are...
Our website is www.redzone.org, And I know on the Yukon Flats issue that the Gwich'in Steering Committee, which is the up in the Arctic Refuge, the people who are, you know, working to preserve that incredible, amazing place where all the porcupine, caribou, and the Gwich'in thrive, you know, they're very concerned about that development, as well as red oil. And red oil is resisting environmental degradation on indigenous lands. And there is a statewide network that we formed here in Cordova. It's run by Faith Gimmel. And, you know, the Gwich'in are some of the best stewards, the hardest fighters. You know, they're doing everything they possibly can to preserve their way of life. And the Yukon Flats issue is much like, you know, what's happening in the Arctic Refuge or Pebble Mine or the Copper River Delta or any of these different areas in Alaska that are threatened, is that what people need to understand is that, yes, the endangered plants and animals are important to the planet. I absolutely agree. But the endangered peoples and our culture is equally as important. So when we take conservation and we add humanity by thinking of the endangered peoples and culture, what's going to happen is we're going to create a whole new level of funding for conservation that currently doesn't exist, because we'll be adding humanity to the mix. And it's so important that people realize that commercial fishermen are an endangered species. Native peoples are an endangered species. Conservationists are an endangered species. That we're running out of habitat. And so, you know, it all comes down to us and just, you know, figuring out that, you know, everybody has a right to have diversity, and they all have a right to life in pursuit of happiness. And in this region, you know, we have the right to live this way of life. And so in Alaska, you know, we love it here. Yes, it's cold and it's snowy and it's windy and it's a lot of ocean and, you know, there's wild animals and the good portion of the state is wild, but that's how we want to live. And we'll always be able to support millions of meals to the people out there in the world that want to have the best seafoods and the best wildlife on the planet.
And also as we're winding up here, Dun, too, the South Korean elder who owns this land, who wants, I gather, he wants to bestow it to you into safekeeping. How shall we bless him? You know, do you want to just bring a little bit of him on, you know, into our hearts so that we can go, yes, may it happen, the path open, 7.9 million, March 31st. What's his part of the story?
Yes, Dr. Shin is an amazing gentleman who, you know, has worked with me for 10 years to try and figure out how to do this. And the thing about the Korean people is that when they go to develop a region, they, you know, think about the chi of the area. And they bring in chi doctors. And they come in and they bless the place and they think about all of the, you know, the good and the bad and the evil and everything that it's going to, what they're going to do to the land. And in this case, it's going to be mountaintop removal. You know, what they're thinking is like, how can we make this right? And I really believe that in this gentleman's heart, that he believes that by returning the land back to the indigenous peoples who were the original stewards of the land, that he'll be able to live with himself and all the development that he's done over the last 30, 40 years of destroying all of the fossil fuels on the planet, like the rest of industry and government. This man wants to do the right thing. And so he's being a visionary leader to help lead us down the path of change and sustainability and harnessing the natural energy of the wind and the tides and the sun and you know, just figure out how to do business differently and create energy without having to destroy the environment so we can survive.
Blessings.
So, you know,
yes, no, that's good. We're on our way out. We bless you, Dun Lankert, absolutely, and we step up to pledge and redzone.org, and we bless Dr. Shin and all the visionary activists who are in cahoots, and we give you a woof, 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 a roar, and we thank Erica Bridgman and Eden. Bless your heart, Eden, out there in Berkeley, and also Andrew Chadwick here in Washington, D.C., for a copy of the show. You can go to visionaryactivism.com, and we will reconvene next week. Thank you so much, Dun.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you, thank you. Come on, bye. Oh, yeah, Jay.
With the recommendation of the Finance Committee of the Pacifica National Board of Directors, six directors have proposed an amendment to Article 6, Section 1 of the Pacifica Bylaws. This amendment would reduce the required number of annual in-person Pacifica National Board meetings from 4 to 3 and would continue the practice of alternating the board meetings among the 5 foundation radio stations.